What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Aaron Penkin, new president of the Hebrew Union College. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. What will Judaism be like in America in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years? That's the crystal ball question that the American Jewish community asks itself on a pretty constant basis, more so these days than ever before. We live in a mobile society in which traditional allegiances can no longer be assumed, where things trend and disappear faster than ever, where millennials are less likely to join or commit to long-term relationships with people, organizations, and certainly religious affiliations. What does all that mean for a 3,800-year-old faith? What are the trends and changes we can expect to see in Jewish life in this country, where we are so broadly accepted that assimilation may seem to be an inevitability? We Jews have thrived in the United States, and we've created many Jewish institutions that are successful and well-established. In fact, you can easily make the case that the American Jewish community of the 20th and 21st centuries is the most integrated and successful Jewish community in our nearly 4,000 years of history, with perhaps the sole exception of Israel today and the ancient Judean and Israelite states long ago in Israel. Jews are at the pinnacle of achievement in almost every area of American life. But the truth is that all these wonderful Jewish institutions we have founded, and which seem to be flourishing, are in some trouble these days. Without a vibrant Jewish community that remains committed to their perpetuation and development, they will not be vibrant in the coming decades. Many of them may not survive. You see, there's always an inherent tension in non-Orthodox religions between tradition and change. This is particularly true here in America, a land of seemingly perpetual and often dynamic change. If you are Orthodox, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, really any kind of orthodoxy, you may be troubled by the changes in the society going on around you, but the inherent structure of your own religious experience and the allegiances and commitments you adhere to are not so likely to be swayed by societal turmoil. It's the nature of orthodoxy to stay mostly the same. But if your religious tradition is more connected to contemporary life, if you believe that your way of expressing your own beliefs should be contemporary too, then you are constantly engaged with an ever-changing world, and the pace of that change seems to be accelerating today. This is both a wonderful opportunity and a continuing challenge. On the one hand, you have the chance to embrace new ideas, new music, new ways of seeking God, new ways of learning. It keeps you fresh and energized. You can discover that no 2 days are the same. On the other hand, your own commitment to that religious tradition is constantly stretched, even challenged. In what areas should your tradition change? In what ways should it remain constant? What insights can you bring to the new issues and ideas at play in the world? And, if you're a religious leader, how can you reshape what you do to reach a changing constituency without alienating the people you already have? This is what makes Reform Judaism so interesting today and so challenging. We have to be both dynamic and traditional, diverse, but also deep. And we need to find ways of reaching a population that seems both more fickle and less focused than ever before, without losing sight of the great depth of Jewish learning, ethics, and spiritual inspiration that are our very reason for being. There's an old saying, Schwerz ist ein Jid. That means it's hard to be a Jew. Well, it's hard in very different ways these days. While in most ways here in America, it's easier to be Jewish than it's ever been, In another sense, it's harder to find the ways that we can guarantee Jewish connection and commitment to the remarkable experience of being a Jew in a free land. But that's also what makes it so very interesting. Free land. You know, speaking of freedom, we are now entering the period preceding the festival of Passover, our great holiday of freedom. It's coming up in mid-April. There is no Jewish holiday that takes nearly as much preparation as Pesach, with the special dietary requirements, the week-long prohibition on using many of the foods we eat and cook with all year, and, of course, the complex and closely ordered Seder meals for family and friends. You can make a case that prepping for Pesach is an entire season of the year all by itself for an observant Jew. To get us ready for the coming festival of Matzah and Freedom, not in that order, here's the first of our pre-Passover previews of Pesach song from the classic Moroccan Israeli singer Yehoram Gaon, Kadesh Rochatz, the seemingless Seder Shel Pesach, the order of the ritual meal itself, the Passover Seder. Kadesh Rochatz, Ekare Paseyachatz, Magid Rochetzah, Motzi Matzah. Maharor Ekorech, Shulecha Neorech, Tzafun Barech, Halel Niretzah. Kadesh Urechatz, Ekare Paseyachatz, Magid Rachetzah, Motzi Matzah. That was Kadesh Rochatz in a Moroccan style for the coming holiday of Passover. It'll be here in mid-April for a week and more of matzah. The historic seminary in America, Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, which began ordaining rabbis back in 1875, has had very few presidents in its illustrious history. We'll meet the new one, Rabbi Aaron Pankin. Find out what we can expect from the premier Reform rabbinical school in the world when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics. And they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Aaron Pankin. He is the new president of Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion. I must, in all candor, admit, one of my alma maters. He's 49 years old. He taught rabbinic and Second Temple literature at HUCJR in New York, served as vice president for strategic initiatives, dean of the New York campus, dean of students, and he now succeeds Rabbi David Ellenson, the 11th president in the history of HUCJR over 138 years, who is now the chancellor. Good morning and welcome and mazel tov.
Good morning. Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
So is this a big yarmulke to fill? What's the right description?
Yes, I think I've heard a lot of people have said that I have big shoes I'm stepping into, a big yarmulke. It might even be a big talus. You never know. But it's definitely something large to fill, no question.
This has not changed hands very often, the presidency of HUCJR. Rabbi David Ellenson, a close friend of yours and mine, succeeded almost unexpectedly, and nobody knew if he could raise funds, which is certainly a big part of the job. What do you think the most challenging aspect of heading HECJR is now for you?
Well, I think there are a couple of different things. The most challenging aspect probably is the continuation of the wonderful fundraising that David Ellenson's been able to do. That's certainly an important priority for the College Institute. But I also think that the North American Jewish community is changing. I think if you look at the Pew Report or you look at the, you know, a number of other studies of the community, we have to think of new and very creative ways to get ourselves into the minds of young Jews and to help them understand the import of the Jewish religion. We have to think of new ways to reach out and new places to be that I think will put us in a position where we can really welcome them into their tradition with open arms.
HECJIR was the first ordaining institution created in America. What is the best way to stay ahead of the curve in today's kind of complex Jewish and academic world?
Well, I think, you know, look, our greatest resource, I think, for us is really our faculty. We have an extraordinary faculty, about 47 full-time faculty members across all our campuses, and hundreds more of adjuncts and other folks who are involved in teaching our students. They come from all the different denominations of Judaism. They come from Israel. They come from North America. They come from Europe, etc. And to us, really, I think faculty has to be absolutely top-notch, and that's the way to stay on top of and really in front of the trends that are affecting Judaism going forward. We're also very tied into a lot of communities around North America and around the world. The fact is that we have about 150 to 200 congregations, which have existed for decades in many cases, because our students go out and serve them on a regular basis. So that means that our students are really right at the beating heart of the Jewish community and very much connected to what's happening. So we hear about that, we talk about it, we think about it, we innovate, and we spend a lot of time thinking what we need to be doing to really reinforce and build the Jewish community going forward.
We will talk a great deal more with President Aaron Pankin of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion when we return this morning on Too Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke International, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. What is Freedom Smoke International?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. Freedom Smoke USA is an electronic cigarette company based right here out of Tucson. We were the first store in the United States, the first store to have all FDA-approved products. It's a healthier alternative to cigarette smoking.
No smoke, no tobacco, and doctors refer people to you.
That's correct. My doctor actually just gave me a glowing report from other patients he's had that I've been able to find this as a healthier alternative to smoking.
Cardiologists, pulmonologists, even dentists, huh?
That's correct. It does help with all that.
How many flavors can people get of this?
We have over 700 flavors available.
Where are the locations and how do people get connected?
Our first location is at River and Orange Grove. We opened one at Broadway and Swan, and we currently just had our grand opening at 12th and Valencia.
And we do have a store in Southern Michigan also.
And what phone number can people call?
You can call the toll-free number at 1-800-705-7013. That's freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thank you, and we'll talk some more next week. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can stream past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is coming June 11th to June 23rd, 2014. If you're interested in going on a fabulous journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to Jerusalem, please email tojewishradio18@gmail.com, tojewishradio18@gmail.com, or call 520-327-4501 for information and a chance to learn about the fabulous itinerary. Baseball season officially began last week. The LA Dodgers played the Arizona Diamondbacks. Now, if this seems a week or two early, not spring training, but the major league season opening in mid-March, that's because it is. For marketing reasons, they began the 2014 season at the Sydney Cricket Grounds in Australia. That's the traditional opening day experience for the American national pastime, isn't it? Actually, I always thought that opening day was supposed to be in Cincinnati, home of the very first professional baseball team way back in 1869, but apparently I'm wrong. And American baseball seasons now open in Japan or across the international dateline, way down under.
Once a jolly swagman can buy a billabong under the shade of a coolabah tree, and he sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda.
There is something completely bizarre about this. Nothing against Australia. I actually love Australia. I lived and worked in Sydney as a rabbi and cantor for 4 months about 20 years ago. Sydney's a great city. Australia is a delightful country, and it has a vibrant, interesting Jewish community as well. In fact, when I lived down there, I actually played in a club baseball game in the city of Cairns, going against cricket players in their off-season on a field surrounded by sugarcane. They were pretty good players, to be honest. But baseball is a pretty traditional American sport, and some things, it seems to me, should remain a little more sacrosanct, like opening day being held on American soil. Well, in keeping with my own preference for traditional things, apparently, here is our traditional too Jewish playing of Take Me Out to the Ball Game, with music by the Jewish Tin Pan Alley tunesmith Albert von Tilzer.
Mitz mit der Ball geht zu Eulen, wo mir doch geht. Kauf mir den Nislach und Cracker Jack, will ich kein Mulf und dort nicht weg. Ich seh gut, mut die Ballspieler, es passt nicht als ein Verspiel. Weil sie sehen, sie weht, drei Steigs neus bei der Baseballspiel.
So that was our too Jewish traditional version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game, sung in Yiddish by Mandy Patinkin for baseball's strange opening day last week in Sydney, Australia. We welcome our Mivinar expert on Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Israel Center here in Tucson, Arizona. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Shalom Rabbi.
So there's been a big controversy in Israel about the draft law. There are certain exemptions given to yeshiva students. It used to be a small number up until the 1970s. Now I've heard 50 or 60,000 yeshiva students don't have to go in the draft. But in Israel, all men are drafted. Women also typically serve.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about what the military means and why this draft law has become very controversial on an attempt to remove the exemption.
Yeah. So as you said to me earlier, in terms of need, maybe we need the Israel military, Israel IDF need less soldiers, but to serve at the IDF, it's not just, you know, because there is a, you know, war upcoming or something like this. It's part of being Israeli. It's to serve the army. It's like part of building your Jewish Israeli identity. You need to serve at the army, even if you're putting two years of being clerk or serving coffee, but it's never like this. I'm just taking it to
well,
extreme.
Everybody goes through basic training anyway.
And so you know what, Rabbi? Every duty, it's a meaningful duty. So, and it's because it's really, you're going through a process that making you more Israeli. I don't know if I'm putting this in the right word in English, but it's kind of a civilization process like chivrut, like you need to do it in order to feel Israeli. And then even whatever you will do next, if you will serve the Israel as a politician or you will go to academy, whatever, it will be part of your identity.
So to me, Israelis are very different from Americans this way. Yes, many Americans serve in the military, but the vast majority do not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite possible to rise to a high level, to become president of the United States without having served in the military. Mm-hmm. That's almost inconceivable in Israel.
Yes.
Everybody's part of it. So the socializing process of being in the military, that's how you advance in society. Isn't there also a certain resentment among Chilonim, among non-Orthodox, non-ultra-Orthodox Jews, to the ultra-Orthodox Jews who do not serve, the Dasim, the Datim, who don't serve in the military?
Do you ask if there is also Chilonim that not serving?
Well, there are some. No, I'm just asking about the relationship between the people that serve and the people that don't.
Of course it creates resentment, how do you say?
Yes.
Yeah,
sure.
Among other parts of Israelis that do serve, but maybe it's for our next show. It's not a problem also only for the ultra-Orthodox. There is also lots of secular people that part of their lack of Jewish identity and connection to Israel also refuse to serve the army. But this is for a different topic.
We'll talk about that next week.
Yeah, we'll talk about
Thanks, Ashrat.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking about the Ukraine last week, which has been very much in the news, and mentioned that so many Jews in America have their origins in what's very loosely called Russia. Now, very little of that was really Russia. There weren't that many Jews in Russia proper, but the Ukraine, Belarus, Lithuania, Latvia, all of the sort of Eastern European area that Russia controlled. Now, no longer part of Russia, but still under Russian influence. It's a very complicated mix.
Right. Well, we have to remember that borders in Europe have shifted radically and frequently over the past 1,000 years.
Came from Russia, Poland, it was, some area between the two.
Right. So what looks on the map like Poland today was historically split between Russia and Germany, and for long periods of time didn't exist on the map at all.
Yeah, Poland wasn't even there.
Even though there was a Polish church and there were Poles who spoke Polish and maintained Polish folk traditions, it wasn't a political entity. And there's the southeastern third of Poland that was part of Austro-Hungary, in fact, where Krakow is, for example. But there's two points to be made here. One, you've already touched on, which is the vast majority of American Jews can trace their ancestry to what was loosely called Russia, which means parts of the Tsar's empire, but not really Russia itself because of the Pale of Settlement. The Russians didn't want Jews in Russia proper, so they kept them in these sort of borderlands going from Latvia and Lithuania in the north all the way to Moldova and Crimea in the south. Odessa was once had the world's largest Yiddish-speaking population, Warsaw and New York.
Yeah, kind of the New York City of that part of the world.
But that technically today is Ukraine,
right,
which is, by the way, no longer politically correct to say the Ukraine, which we used to say. It's
right.
Now Ukraine tout court.
I have learned.
Anyway, the... There is one other point to be made here for your listeners who may not be familiar with this. So we talked last week about the complicated, historic, close, but love-hate and ambivalent relationship between Russians and Ukrainians. But it should be noted that Russians today and their Soviet antecedents before them, and certainly the Tsars before them, had a different attitude towards Slavic populations, which is mainly Belarus and Ukraine, from all the non-Slavic peoples whom they really did regard as foreigners. So whether you're talking about the Christian nations of the Caucasus, like Georgia and Armenia, or the mostly Muslim nations of Central Asia, plus Azerbaijan, those people were clearly considered different because they weren't Slavic speakers and they weren't part of the Russian Orthodox Church. Whether they were Christians or not didn't matter. And the same is true in spades for the Baltic countries, which were annexed by the Soviet Union long after the revolution, which were not traditionally held by the Tsar, and one of which, at least at one point in history, Lithuania, had a huge empire of its own. It was more important historically than Poland. And the Russians in those Baltic countries were always a small and sometimes frightened minority. And that's where the revolution that broke the Soviet Union up began. And those are the countries where Russia is least likely to try to reassert control or try to resist strongly membership in NATO or the European Union. In fact, those countries are already part of the Union. With Ukraine and Belarus, it's a whole different kettle of fish, and that's part of what's been going on now.
Well, we'll talk about that next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. One Sunday, Rabbi Rabinowitz goes to visit a congregant to raise some funds for the temple. "Shalom, Sam," he says. "I'll come straight to the point. I've come here because our synagogue needs your help. You've been a member for over 20 years. I realize you're always quick to pay your dues. But, as you're aware, we're in a financial crisis. I've come to ask you for a little extra for the new school building." "How much are you looking to get from me? How big is a little?" asks Sam. "I'll be honest, $50,000 would be a tremendous help to us," replies the rabbi. So Sam responds, "Rabbi, my daughter Rebecca is getting married soon. She asked me for $100,000 for the down payment on the house she saw. My son David is just starting at the university. He wants $60,000 a year there. My wife Sadie needs plastic surgery. She asked for $70,000 for doctors and hospitals. And that's not all. You know from your own experience that having my mother in a kosher Jewish nursing home is $75,000 a year. So, Rabbi, if I can say no to them, I can say no to you, too." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read one of the least appetizing portions of the whole year, Tazria from the book of Leviticus. It contains instructions on the treatment of a truly horrible ancient illness, leprosy, that still exists in the world, although it isn't much in evidence in America these days, thank God. Tazria delineates the ways in which we are to treat those individuals afflicted with this terrible, frightening disease that our ancestors regarded as contagious. The method specified, basically sanitary conditions and quarantine, we still use today. They're often considered to be state-of-the-art medical means to control unknown infections. Nor is there any moral valence placed in the Torah on those who are ill. People infected with the dread skin affliction are not considered to have brought it on themselves by any bad action or error. Rather, they are simply unfortunate and are isolated for their own protection and for that of the general societies. In the ancient world, this was simply the cutting-edge treatment for the infirm, far ahead of what most cultures would do even millennia later. But even in our own world, we should be aware that we rarely treat those who are gravely ill with frightening illnesses in a good way. You may remember when the AIDS epidemic began, there was general panic about how to treat those who were infected. And with no justification, many individuals were ostracized from schools, neighborhoods, and society in general. It took years of education and experience before we began to understand that complex ailment and were able to deal with it intelligently and sometimes sensitively. While we are more scientifically knowledgeable about disease today, we are probably no more emotionally advanced in dealing with dreaded illnesses than our Israelite forebears were 3,000 years ago, as demonstrated by our Torah portion of Tazria. Our ancestors, too, turned to God for help. but they also generally treated those who were ill with compassion and care. A good lesson that we can learn from them, even today. When we return on To Jewish, Rabbi Aaron Pankin, the new head of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, the premier ordaining institution in the Reform world, will tell us what new directions we can expect from this great historic institution. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Things heated up on the Syrian border for Israel last week when four Israeli soldiers were wounded by a roadside bomb in the Golan Heights. Israel retaliated with airstrikes on Syrian army positions, killing one and wounding seven. Israel actually announced these air raids. That's opposed to its official silence about past strikes on arms from Syria believed destined for Lebanon's Hezbollah guerrilla military terrorists. By doing this, Israel clearly delivered a message to President Bashar al-Assad, deterrence. Our policy is clear. We hurt those who hurt us, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu told his cabinet in public remarks. Syrian elements not only allowed but also cooperated in the attacks on our forces, he said, and by taking military action now, Israel wanted to ensure calm was reestablished along the northern frontier. The attack came less than a month after Hezbollah accused Israel of carrying out an airstrike on one of its bases in the Lebanon-Syria border. It vowed at the time it would respond. In last week's terror attack, a bomb was detonated near an Israeli patrol along a fence between Israel's section of the Golan and the part under Syrian control. One of the four wounded soldiers remains in critical condition. Although suspicion in Israel fell on Hezbollah, Israeli leaders did not point a finger directly at the Shiite Muslim terrorist group, which is allied with Assad in battling a three-year-old civil war against his rule led by Sunni Islamist insurgents, among others. We hold the Assad regime responsible for what happens in its territory, and if it continues to collaborate with terrorists striving to hurt Israel, then we will keep on exacting a heavy price from it and make it regret its actions, Israel Defense Minister Moshe Ya'alon said. In other news, David Brenner, the gangly, toothy grin Tonight Show favorite, whose brand of observational comedy became a staple for other stand-up comedians, including Jerry Seinfeld and Paul Reiser, died of cancer last week. He was 78.
Well, when I was a kid, the only dirty book we actually had was National Geographic. Oh, we used to run down the alley, all the guys with the National Geographic. I was about 15 years old before I found out when a woman gets naked, she's not holding a spear.
David Brenner was a huge star when I met him, and he took me under his wing. To me, historically, he was the godfather of hip observational comedy, comedian Richard Lewis said. He mentored me from day one. His passing leaves a hole in my life that can never be replaced. Brenner's stand-up routines became a favorite of Tonight Show host Johnny Carson starting in the 1970s.
Of course, I don't buy anything mechanical, cars. I have no luck. If it has two moving parts, it breaks on me. Everything. Like a couple weeks ago, I bought a hair blower. It sucks.
David was one of the most respected and liked comedians by his peers. He was always right there helping young comedians, whether they were Richard Lewis, Freddie Prinze, or Jimmy Walker. He was still doing it until the very end. May he rest in peace.
Hear me now, the bleak and unbearable world, thou art base and debauched as can be. And the night, with his banners all bravely unfurled, now hurls down his gauntlet to thee. I am I, Don Quixote, the Lord of La Mancha, my destiny calls.
and the wild winds of fortune shall carry me onward, oh, whithersoever they blow. Whithersoever they blow, onward to glory I go.
Composer Mitch Lee, the Brooklyn-born son of a Jewish furrier from Ukraine, had no theater experience. All he had ever done was compose incidental music for a couple of short-lived Broadway comedies. Suddenly, he was asked to write the music for a new show that was going to be tried out in East Haddam, Connecticut. A few numbers about guests and wine and beautiful women, so Lee gave it a shot. That show, The Man of La Mancha, opened in New York the next year and ran until 1971, a total of 2,328 performances, then a record. It won 5 Tonys, including Best Composer and Lyricist and Best Musical. Richard Kiley played the dual role of Don Quixote, the gentleman knight with the grand imagination, and Quixote's creator, the Spanish author Miguel de Cervantes. Since then, Man of La Mancha, Lee's creation, has appeared on countless stages around the globe. It's been a staple of American regional theater, was transformed into a 1972 movie starring Peter O'Toole, and enjoyed 4 Broadway revivals.
To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, to run where the brave dare not go, to right the unrightable wrong, to love pure and chaste from afar, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreachable star. This is my quest, to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know.
The show's signature number, The Impossible Dream, whose lyrics refer to fighting for the right without question or pause and being willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause, has been recorded by many, many, many artists, including Placido Domingo and Frank Sinatra. It was sung at the memorial service of Senator Edward M. Kennedy by the star of the most recent revival, Brian Stokes Mitchell. The New York Times review of a production in 2002 described the song, With Weariness, as one of the most pervasive anthems of uplift in showbiz history, a song that presumably will wail on for as long as there are piano bars. Lee, who never had another Broadway hit, died last week in Manhattan at the age of 86. His name, when he was born, was Erwin Michnick. Mitch Lee grew up in the Brownsville neighborhood of Brooklyn, served in the Army, went to Yale on the GI Bill, got his bachelor's and master's degrees there. He never apologized for working mostly in advertising, and he never gave it up, just because he had a couple of Tony Awards on his mantelpiece. In an interview, he contended there's more musical freedom on Madison Avenue than anywhere else. It's an Eden for a composer.
Everybody doesn't like something, but nobody doesn't like Sara Lee. Everybody doesn't like something, but nobody doesn't like Sara Lee.
Among other clients, Mitch Lee wrote jingles for L&M Cigarettes, Kennel Ration Dog Food, and Consolidated Foods, which became the Sara Lee Corporation. The music for the eternal jingle, Everybody Doesn't Like Something, But Nobody Doesn't Like Sara Lee, that was written by Mitch Lee.
And the world will be better for this. That one man, scorned and covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage to reach the unreachable star.
Mitch Lee, a Jewish kid from Brownsville, died last week. He only had one Broadway success, The Man of La Mancha, but it will quite likely live forever. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Aaron Penkin is the new president of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, the Reform Movement's Rabbinical Cantorial Educational School, Social Work School for professionals throughout the movement. Aaron, what has changed in the time that you've been at HUC? What's changed about the college?
That's a great question. So I started about 17 years ago on the faculty and being involved in the college as a professor and as a dean. But I actually have a longer history because before that, about 9 years before that, I'd been involved as a student. So it really works out to about 26 years. I've been connected to the college in a pretty intense way. I would say a couple of very major things. We've moved from a faculty that was by and large male and was by and large schooled in what you would call the Wissenschaft school of the study of kind of scientific Judaism, right? Yes, that arose in Europe. And we really, I think, have Americanized in many ways. That means that we have about 50% of our faculty is now female, 50% of our students are now female. We think a lot more about issues like spirituality and outreach and looking for ways to connect to Jewish individuals who are thinking not just in, you know, what I would say sort of high intellectual ways, but in ways that, you know, deal with the real social trends and the real questions that confront Americans going forward. So I think we're much more aligned in a sense with where America is right now, and that I think is very positive because it allows our faculty and our students to have the important conversations that we need to have about American Jews.
Speaking not only about the gender changes within the student body, there are many other kinds of ethnic changes within the student body at HUCJR. Some of that's happened in your time there. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Did you say ethnic?
Yeah, in terms of one Jewish parent as opposed to two Jewish parents, backgrounds that are Asian, African American, all kinds of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, our students do come from all different races. We've had a number of different students of African American background. We have had students of Asian background, as you said. We have students who come from anywhere in the world, from New Zealand out to Singapore and Hong Kong and all sorts of great places. And the reality is, especially in our PhD programs, we serve actually not just the Jewish community. We actually train a good number of folks who end up teaching in Bible colleges, Christian Bible colleges throughout the Midwest and the South. So we really do have a very diverse student body. But at the same time, our core is really in the training of Jewish professionals. And I will say also that training has changed as another one of the things that has changed over the years, in that we've really thought a lot about major issues that deal with professional development. I talk about actually the dual core processor. In other words, in your home computer, I used to be an electrical engineer, and in your home computer, you actually have two processors that work in tandem. And by working together, they actually do a far better job in processing whatever you need processed and in making your computer run quickly and accurately. So the dual core processor for Hebrew Union College is really to think about the incredible commitment that we have to traditional text learning. That means that a student who comes through our program spends a lot of time on Bible, Mishnah, Talmud, Midrash, medieval codes, Jewish philosophy, Hebrew, etc., to make sure that they're really well-versed in what's going on in the Jewish traditional outlook and that they understand and have real serious access to the texts of Judaism. And I think that's a critical part of being a rabbi, a cantor, an educator. But I also think that our students really need to know the practical skills, and that's what we've really worked on developing in the last couple of decades. And that means to know what it means to be a pastoral counselor, to know what it means to stand at a bedside with a person who's having difficulty in a hospital and their family and have to figure out what I can do to help this family and how I can help this family move forward in a religious way that is deep and thoughtful and meaningful and that is comforting and important in their lives. We've thought a lot about education and the new trends in education and how distance learning, for example, or autonomous or asynchronous learning and how we think about that for students in religious schools, for example, or how we take a camp experience and how our professionals can really take a camp experience and turn it into something meaningful and life-changing. We also think about questions of making sure that someone who comes out of our programs actually can read a budget sheet or work with a board or do fundraising. These are all skills that actually we're very proud. We really help our students develop over the years. And that to me is really the kind of hallmark of a great professional. It's got, that person has that incredible commitment to Jewish tradition and learning, but also has the ability to actually actualize it in the world and make it mean something.
And you know, and that's quite a change, really a transformational change. When I was in rabbinical school, we had one or two classes in practical rabbinics, which were, to be honest, not terribly practical. Nobody told us, I don't think there was any classes in how to deal with a budget. There wasn't really anything about group process or developing leadership. Any of those skill sets were not actually taught. They are taught now.
Yep, they are. And, you know, look, that there's always, of course, in everything like this, there's always a tension and a balance, and there's only a limited amount of time to be able to put, you know, all these elements in place. So we have to be careful about that balance. But I do feel that we've adjusted the balance in a very positive direction.
Let's talk about maybe a challenging question. There are four campuses of Hebrew Union College, Los Angeles, Cincinnati, New York, and Jerusalem. Cincinnati was the mothership and the center, really, of HUC for a very long time. Some of that shifted around. Is there a tension in continuing four campuses, supporting four campuses with all of the services that you provide?
You know, I'll tell you that I love all my campuses equally, I would say. I don't think of any as really the mothership or anything like that. I think each of them are in interesting places which have Jewish communities where we can do a lot for those Jewish communities, and we can actually have our students learn a lot from each of those Jewish communities, and they're different, which is wonderful. So it means that we really have the opportunity to offer our students great experiences, whether they'd like to be in a larger coastal city, whether they'd like to be in Israel, whether they'd like to be in Cincinnati, which has a very vibrant and wonderful Jewish community, is actually a model for a medium-sized Jewish community, which I think is quite powerful for our students. But, you know, my approach to this has been that what we'd like to do is we'd like to make sure that each of our communities really benefits from the College Institute and that we really develop each campus to be embedded beautifully and thoughtfully within its community. And I'll give you just a couple of examples of that. In Jerusalem, most recently, we've spent a lot of time developing a couple of new programs, one of which is a program in pastoral counseling that actually takes Israelis and teaches them how to do pastoral counseling. And the amazing thing is that there hasn't been a massive pastoral counseling development as there has been in the States. There's no CPE, clinical pastoral education programs. There's just a lot of things missing in the way Israel deals with pastoral counseling issues. And we've become really a leader in helping Israelis. You know, for example, the people in the army who have to show up and actually counsel a family who has lost a soldier. We actually have become a great training center for individuals who have to actually think about these pastoral issues in Israeli society. And because of what America's done, which is somewhat different and a little more advanced sometimes than Israeli society in this particular area, we've actually been quite helpful to them. We also have a pluralistic education program in Jerusalem now, which brings together people of all strands of Judaism to talk about and think about what does pluralism mean in a very deep way, and in a way that's actually quite difficult at times, because sometimes you have to actually think carefully about, you know, how do I hold on to my belief and yet be open to a very opposing and a very different kind of belief. So that's a great example of what we're trying to do in each community. In Cincinnati, for example, we have opened up a vital services center, the Barbesh Vital Services Center, which is a food pantry and a vital services center for people who are in need in the Cincinnati Jewish community and beyond. We've also created a service learning program where now we're sending out many, many of our students with stipends into community organizations and spending time actually working within the community and learning from the experience with supervision and other kinds of ways to help students grow as they do these things. In New York and Los Angeles, we do a lot of cultural events. We do a lot of events that bring folks to our communities. So I think, you know, my goal here is really to develop each campus in the best possible way it can be developed, and obviously, you know, that requires resources, and we have to do fundraising more than if we had one campus, let's say, instead of four. But it seems to me a very worthwhile kind of thing, and there are a lot of wonderful opportunities for us in that sense going forward.
Let's follow up a little bit in talking particularly about Israel, the Jerusalem campus. I recall when, you know, two or three Israeli rabbis were ordained in a year and sometimes in longer. There's a much greater need now in Israel. The Reform movement is growing. Talk a little bit about what's happening there.
Well, I was over in Israel actually about 2.5 weeks ago for the week, and I have to say it was one of the most exciting visits I've had. I've been going there for about 30 years and go there often, have lived there, love it very much. But what was so exciting this time, in November I was there too, and what I noticed actually was that we ordained now our 89th Reform rabbi for the Israeli Reform movement actually in November. And we're now at a point where I think the progressive movement, the Reform movement, has really moved into a kind of major moment of ascent in Israel. There's greater acceptance, the surveys show, amongst the Israeli mainstream, and that's because many, many more people have now been to B'nai Mitzvah and to weddings and to funerals and other sorts of things that have been officiated at by Reform rabbis. So the acceptance is growing very much. The other thing is now that we have the capacity, the personnel on the ground, because of all the ordinees we have, that puts us in a very different position because it means that there are people in smaller towns now. For example, we have a student who's working in Cholon, which is, you know, not the largest town, but it's an interesting place. And, you know, what's great about that is that's a whole city that actually now has a possibility of developing a kind of Reform Jewish outlook and presence that never existed before. So we're up to around, we're actually over 40 different initiatives across the land of Israel now. Not everything's a congregation, but each one of those 40 indicates some sort of significant presence for the Reform movement in Israel, which means we've really now covered all the major cities significantly, and we're really now in a place where we're starting to really expand the presence and the outlook of Reform Judaism. I also think that the Women at the Wall program, those kinds of conversations have also led people to think about a more pluralistic Judaism, and I think we've really got some wonderful, wonderful opportunities as the years go forward, now that we have a critical mass of people who are interested in Reform Judaism. So, so that's very exciting to me.
Yeah, extraordinarily exciting times there. One last quick question. Your own work was in Talmud and the graduation of rabbinic literature. What role does Talmud play in the Reform movement today?
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that question, because I think Talmud can be one of the most inspiring, most important texts for a number of different reasons. In fact, I just wrote an article that's coming out in the CCAR Journal in the next couple of months called The Talmudist Manifesto, because I really do believe that Talmud...
Great title, by the way.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The reality is I think Talmud helps hone your thinking skills. It helps you understand how to do hermeneutics, the interpretation of text. It helps you to figure out what are communal boundaries and what have been communal boundaries in the past and why they might continue or not continue into the current day. And it also helps you with the question of change and innovation. When is it appropriate to change? And that actually was my work in graduate school, which was to look at over 1,000 examples of times when the rabbis changed Jewish law and what the rationales that were acceptable to them were when they made those changes, which is, I think, directly relevant to the task of Reform Judaism. So from my perspective, the Talmud's a great place to study. I try to study daily if I can, every day. And I really spend a tremendous amount of time thinking about what implications it has for Reform Judaism. And I've been teaching for about the last 10 years the introductory Talmud course. And I find that, you know, if introduced well, which most of the time I get around to kind of being at that level, if I introduce it well to students, they realize what an incredible source of wisdom and knowledge and really a great way to reflect on their own selves as Jews, the Talmud really can be.
I want to thank Rabbi Aaron Pankin for a terrific visit here on Two Jewish. Mazel Tov. May you continue to go from strength to strength.
Thank you. Great being with you.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be writer Bruce Feiler, the author of Walking the Bible, on his new book, The Secrets of Happy Families. Our playout this morning comes from a group of Orthodox Jews, a spinoff of the Bratslaver Hasidic sect that does a kind of Orthodox Hasidic rave experience in Israel and elsewhere, with techno-pop and lots of dancing and joy. They're called the Nanachs, based on the name of the 18th century founder of the Bratslavers, Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav. His town in Uman is in the Ukraine. They've become popular with secular Israelis, too, for advocating and sharing a vision of life and Judaism focused on joy and happiness. Imagine that, expressed through, well, dancing and singing in public. This is one of their theme songs called, unsurprisingly, Na Na Nachma Nachman Me'uman. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week full of joy, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Rabbi Nachman.